Thank you.
Thank you.
Have fun.
So because we're using the Jefferson IT backbone, this presentation will run completely on its own, so enjoy. I work in a really interesting mix of spaces between healthcare, government systems, automotive, aeronautic. It's a really interesting place, sports, medicine. And it's allowed me, media, it's allowed me to see very interesting problems from a lot of different areas and how one thing that sits over here somewhere in a silo, or what someone would think of it in a silo, is totally applicable in another space. And often people don't have that. When I work with a lot of companies, they're so focused, or organizations, they're focused on what they're doing. They have the challenges of the day, all the issues that they're focusing on, whether it's purely a bottom line issue, if it's an issue about personnel, or it's say it's an IT backbone issue. It becomes a very myopic, focused conversation. What we try to do is really expand the idea of that. What can the conversation be about? How do technologies that work in some other space add relevance to this space? They may be very expensive in a certain space over here, but they may not be that expensive over here because of a constraint change or otherwise. So our biggest value that we really work around is trying to explore what's possible. And we have a kind of a mantra that we always use: anything's possible. And people, you know, it's easy to cynically look at, well, sure, I guess that's true, or maybe that's not possible at all. When you look at our achievements to date as mankind, through the human condition and otherwise, we've made a lot of things possible that in any form of our brain at a certain period of time was never possible. Simple things like the telephone that we use every day, being able to transmit voice all the way around the world on copper and fiber and satellites and otherwise, it's fascinating. It becomes an easy thing. We pull our cell phone out of our pocket. We use it. We don't even think that much about it. The transaction that actually happens from when you dial and that is sent out, and it's sent out into an exchange, and then it's sent out to a satellite or a fiber connection under the ocean, ends up somewhere else. And every once in a while, we drop calls. I tell people, get over that. It's still pretty amazing. I mean, come on. You could also send a letter. So, you know, looking at the idea, technology will not solve everything, but it gets us down the field a little bit further. My backgrounds range a lot from having these kind of different areas, everything working with NGOs and nonprofits, media organizations, pharmaceutical companies. And again, that idea of understanding all of these different areas and ultimately tool sets from that. So what I've learned in the media industry is how to package content in very interesting ways and how to distribute that content. It's a challenge that is very prevalent in education. Often the quality of the content, unfortunately, because of budget constraints and otherwise, it's hard to make very attractive and approachable. So it becomes a burden. It's a digital learning system. It becomes frustrating to use. It's hard to use. If people won't use it, it's not effective. And if we can't make it effective, we can't move people through that system, how do we know what the efficacy of that program is going to be? So everything we're doing, whether it's called technology or not, it's really the idea of understanding what's out there, the packaging of that, and then being able to turn that into a more usable, more efficacious, usually more inexpensive, because that is usually our largest barrier in almost anything that we deal with is price when it really comes down to it. So how do you take this, package all of these challenges together, and then apply them to different issues? Now, technology as a whole, it's an interesting thing. People talk about technology, but it's really, in essence, it's a very abstract concept. It's amorphous. What's technology? What's it mean? And I was doing some research and just looking at purely from a public awareness standpoint of technology. If you search technology in Google right now, you'll look at the trend has decreased since 2004. Kind of strange. You would think that it would be kind of a constantly evolving trend as we go through that. Search gigahertz, it's decreased. Server, decreased. But what's increased is app. The idea of applications, because it all comes down to the idea of no matter what the technology can't solve the problem. It's the application thereof of the technology. How do you package the technology? How do you create the content? How do you deliver it? You can have the best content in the world, but if you can't get it to the end user, it's useless. You can have the best medical device in the world, but if it costs $400 million, it's going to be very hard to distribute that. So looking at the idea of true applications, we're at a really marvelous place in time where computers are faster than we actually need, which is interesting. That's why we see gigahertz decreasing from a search results, because it's not about that. When's the last time you actually heard Intel inside? Nobody cares anymore. They're faster. Our phones are faster than what our laptops were 2 years ago. So the idea is now we have to keep up with building better applications that use all these technologies. In my phone, in my iPad, even in my laptop, I have accelerometers. I have a temperature sensor, GPS, digital compass. How can you use all of those tools together, these beautiful sensors that literally 2 to 3 years ago would have been hundreds of thousands of dollars turned into a device? If you look at something like the iPhone is actually a great front end for a medical device. It's got a display, has audio, data storage. We can capture physical output from that. We can put it in someone's hand and actually have them do a physical task and record that. We can look at their actual locomotion through that device. I find that fascinating when you're talking about a device that at this point you can get for $99. Now, the applications are very much lacking for that, and we're really trying to push the medical community from that side to understand how to embrace these. Don't be afraid of the technologies, and really find the ways that, you know, the applications that you could think of are possible. You just have to find the right people and skill sets to put them all together. We do also a lot of work in simulation, and that's where coming to Jefferson a few months ago, I got a great tour of the simulation center. And one of the first things I noticed is going through, again, this comes back to application, there's beautiful three floors, technology-enabled, cameras in every room, microphones in every room. You have MediSims, so you actually have the mechanical dummies. You have apparatus simulation, so for laparoscopic or suturing or otherwise. But there's a really interesting kind of difference between this and the simulation of this. When you flip the idea of going from a clinician or otherwise to a patient and understanding what that patient's going through, the idea of looking up from the table instead of down at the table. Exactly, it's frightening, right?
It's a scary picture.
It's frightening. So the idea of how do we help these types of issues as part of a training system, wholly, you know, looking at population health and understanding kind of the global effect of that, the mechanic quality of a clinician needs to slightly shift into the idea of really understanding the empathy of the patient. We found this through doing a bunch of studies. We worked with a number of different institutions and otherwise. And then we had this great opportunity to develop a simulation that allowed us to actually kind of explore this experience. And it was an NYHA Class 2 heart failure simulator. This is fully immersive simulation, so as a clinician, you are strapped into a device that goes around your chest. Just going to bring up the slide for it. You're within a 6-foot pod. There's a display that wraps around you. You have binaural headphones on. So this is different than stereo. This actually allows you to hear a sound that is right here, as opposed to left or right. You could hear it here, you can hear it here. It's different than surround sound. It's very much based on our binaural hearing. So when you're in this simulation, you're walking in the steps of Hank, a 53-year-old ex-smoker class 2 patient that we actually found and built this case study around. Within the simulation, you go through 5 minutes of the different compression feelings of the congestion of the chest. Every time you're breathing, we have full biometric monitoring of that. So we're looking at pulse ox, we're looking at respiratory rate, heart rate, and actual chest expansion. As you exhale, every breath, we slightly bring in the pneumatic vest. So we're not putting anyone in danger by any means, but it's the idea that you're actually now working against your own body. And when you look at going into class 2 or into class 3, this was really designed to help cardiologists understand the difference between the classes. So being able to act much more aggressively in class 2 as opposed to then waiting for class 3 or class 4, which at that time it was just about maintaining quality of life, really, to end of life. So the simulation, within this 5 minutes, you're experiencing the tightness of chest. Your feet are on pedals, so we're actually having you exercise throughout the entire simulation. If you stop pedaling, and the resistance of the pedaling increases as we go through the different stages of heart failure, if you stop pedaling, the simulation stops. You just cannot go any further. So people would say, wow, this is tiring, this is exhausting. And I said, well, that's what your patients are going through. And this was developed with clinicians and patients. We work with patients a lot and clinicians together in the same room so that they understand what the actual issues are. It's not for us to say anything about how it should feel or otherwise. What we do is we help interpret that. So hearing a patient talk about they have an elephant sitting on their chest, or it feels like they're underwater if they're lying down, you know, non-clinical language, the doctor's going to talk about in a very specific way. We're trying to kind of bridge that communication to make sure the doctor understands what the patient's saying, the patient understands and can validate what the doctor's talking about their condition, and then turning that into some form of physical simulation so that by no means this is a game, a toy, a gimmick, or otherwise. We had a cardiologist actually come out of this simulation, the phenomenal story. We were doing these exit interviews for our own efficacy of the simulation, and we asked one doctor if we could speak to him for a few minutes, and he said, not right now, I have to call my mother. He went off, called his mother. We caught up with him a little bit later and started speaking with him. I said, what was that all about? He said, I think my mother has class 2. She's been talking about it in a way that I don't understand. I know the clinical side of this. The way she was speaking of it was everything you described, because we put it into very human language, non-clinical language. So it's not a semantic issue any longer. It's an idea of that we're communicating at a very human level, getting rid of lingo otherwise. I think it's very important to think about that. So with this program, this toured 55 cities. There were 6 simulators within it. It was a 55-foot tractor trailer that would go to teaching hospitals and medical centers. And we debuted at the American Heart Association National Congress in 2006. This now was requested to be in the permanent collection of the Smithsonian for innovation in healthcare education.
Do you drive the truck to the Smithsonian?
Sure. I probably should get a CDL, though. I did drive around the parking lot once. So the interesting evolution from what we learned on what we did with the heart failure simulation, we built an underlying technology. We couldn't find anything that worked for us. IBM came and they wanted to basically sell us a system for $5.5 million for the simulator to control all the simulations, to verify the sensors. That just wasn't in the budget. And that's why I said earlier, the cost-prohibitive nature of technology often doesn't allow things to happen. So we really forced to make things affordable, because if an idea is brilliant, it has to happen. We have to figure out how to make it happen. It's our duty. It's what we have to do. We can't allow just large profit margins and pure technology expense to dictate what we do from an innovation standpoint. So we didn't like what IBM had, we didn't like what Cisco had, we didn't like basically any of the existing technologies, so we built our own. And we ended up running the entire simulation off a set of Mac Minis, $600 computers. We literally purchased them at the Apple Store, configured the first prototype in 2 weeks, so we actually had cardiologists running through a fully working prototype of the simulation in 2 weeks. The entire vehicle, all 6 simulations, plus another 7 simulators that were not in the vehicle for other areas where the truck couldn't actually enter. Entire project was done in 6 months. IBM quoted us 3.5 years to get to the point that we might have a simulation. So the idea of really looking at what the establishment is from a technology standpoint versus what can really be done. We've got a bunch of young college kids, hungry kids who were really interested. They knew it was out there. I had the media background and technology background saying, what if we did this and we put this together? This is not expensive. This is not expensive. Let's work in the middleware, if you will, letting them talk and communicate, and then build this really beautiful platform that became our human condition platform, the HCX platform. That then allowed us to do this multiple sclerosis simulator that was fascinating. We did 2 stages of MS, early and later stage. And these are all story-based simulations because we want real patient case studies within this. So we have a high level of clinical accuracy, but also a human story that's taking you throughout the program. The MS simulation from the early side dealt with a young mother who's just been diagnosed and really is quite frightened of what the disease state is. Her symptomology may change by the day, and she doesn't know what it is. So if her arm falls asleep, did she sleep on her shoulder the wrong way, or is it part of the disease? Going through that daily and trying to communicate that to her clinician and getting through that dialogue of is this part of my symptomology or not? And we went through a lot of these issues with trying to understand how could we simulate a nervous and muscular kind of symptomology from that side. So we built a specially designed treadmill, and these are the outside of the simulation, but we built a specially designed treadmill that had a tread for each foot. We would monitor the gait as you're walking, so we could detect the cadence as you're walking. What we were able to do was vary the speed of the 2 treadles so that you actually tripped. Now, you didn't fall down and trip, but it very much felt like you lost control of your leg. And everyone did the same thing, from the highest level neurologists we were dealing with to patients to the press. Everybody did the same thing. They looked down and usually very bluntly would say, "What the hell just happened?" The sensation of losing your own balance when you know you're perfectly able, but to lose it like that, and everything you know about you from a physical standpoint, it's now gone out the window. It's absolutely frightening. That's what the patient's going through. And so it was so interesting of kind of mirroring that experience, putting in a very repeatable program. We do, as I said earlier, we have full biometric monitoring of everything we do in these simulations. So looking at everything from galvanic skin response for anxiety and stress levels to pulse ox and respiratory rate allows us to look at baselines. We can change the simulation based on how people are actually responding to that. So say their anxiety level is increasing, we may actually want to bring the simulation on more intensely at that point to see how they react to that. We may want to decrease that and get back to a baseline. So it allows the system, and the system does this on its own, so we set thresholds and otherwise, but it allows the system to actually regulate itself based on cases and otherwise. So we can do an early stage of MS, or we can literally load a new profile, and now we have a later stage of MS. It's more intense, dealing with different symptomology, sensitivity to heat, optical neuritis. So you're increasing the symptomology going through. So someone can actually be in a simulation and go from the earliest stage of MS to a much later stage, all within the same five-minute span. Or in this case, we actually did it with two separate experiences so that you went through early stage, you left that simulation, we had programmatic content around that to bring up questions and start a dialogue, and then go in the later stage to complete the entire disease state. And if anyone has questions, please, I don't like to just talk aloud, so please, if anyone has a question, throw it out at any point. The RLS simulator, again, built on the same platform, was all about, this was early in RLS, and the commentary that we heard throughout was RLS is not a real disease. It's a made-up disease by the pharmaceutical companies. As we did part of our discovery process, as we went through, we learned that it was a cousin of Parkinson's, and in extremely severe cases can actually go into other extremities from a nervous condition. So this was meant to actually simulate the range, myriad of symptomology that people were experiencing with RLS. And this, again, came down to very simple technology. So we designed this boot. It was a one-size-fits-all boot. We had pneumatic bladders throughout, so anyone gets the same experience. You mount the boot. It goes up to a certain pressure threshold just to bring, the sensors and actuators in contact with your leg. Then you go through a story of a woman who's she's presented as insomnia. And one thing that we found over and over through the research was that many RLS patients were getting scripts for sleeping aids. So there's a lot of Ambien being prescribed. And the idea was to raise the question when presented as insomnia from the clinician side, ask if it could be your legs. Now, it sounds like a very simple question. Sounds almost like a silly question. How could it be your legs if you're not sleeping? The idea that most people that we talk to from a patient side or otherwise wouldn't even think about bringing it up. They'd be uncomfortable. They toss and turn. A lot of people toss and turn and don't sleep. It was this issue of kind of just addressing it from one specific area. A lot of people said, no, it's not my legs. I never even thought of that. And that's fine. But just bring up that question. So by allowing a clinician to go through this experience, and again, validated on patients, we don't release anything until patients actually say, that's exactly what it feels like. Because we want to make sure that's a realistic experience, again, not any form of gimmick or a novelty, because it really does, it erodes the whole idea of doing the program. And what we found was an immediate shift of by about 14% of the idea of stopping sleep aid and starting therapies for either RLS or not RLS if it was a physical therapy as opposed to a pharmaceutical therapy. So it was just changing the idea that they weren't being prescribed something outside of the class of the disease state. Now, we also do work in medical clinic design, which has been really interesting from a technology standpoint, because as the evolution of materials, because materials are technology, if you think back to technology isn't something that necessarily has to go beep. It's very easy to kind of think in that sense, but a zipper at one point was extremely high technology. Crazy, right? But at whatever given age, an arrowhead, extremely high technology for the time. So where we are now is trying to understand, use every form of technology. It doesn't have to be electronic by any means. These clinics have been designed all with antimicrobacterial surfaces, UV cleansing bulbs that go on after each visit. We built basically a system all based on usability studies. These are small, 150 square foot units that can be dropped in to areas that need a clinic that doesn't have any infrastructure built. So if it's literally in a, say, a strip mall or otherwise, and a neighborhood clinic needs to be built, reducing the cost of the overall capital expansion cost and getting it down to the side of what does this allow the clinician to work with in the best efficacious way, but also in a comfort way for patient and clinician. Security, privacy, we've integrated issues, EMR and otherwise, into these systems. And the idea that these can be dropped in at very low cost and be operational in anywhere from 5 to 15 days, depending on the location. So you had broadbands, you had water, you had HVAC, power. It's fairly operational. And this has also led to a lot of the work that we do in Africa, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. And I mentioned earlier the idea of the iPhone as an amazing kind of platform or otherwise. Now, not just the iPhone. There's a number of phones that can do this. There's another devices. But the idea that in your hand you have an extremely powerful medical device and trying to find applications for that. And I would challenge you all as clinicians and in the healthcare profession, think about if you could close your eyes and imagine what would a diagnostic tool look like for you? How could you use something? How have you imagined something, envisioned it? That's always what we're looking to do, is try to take those ideas and otherwise. We're not sitting around all the time saying, well, if we only had this device, we could do this. We're not in the field the same way that you guys are, and we're always looking for that. So I challenge everyone in the room, think about how you can come up with the idea of something. Most likely, you can create an application for it, even if it has to plug in with another sensor or otherwise. If we can reduce the cost of medical products as a whole, we reduce the cost of healthcare, which is one of our biggest issues. And I think the cost of medical products as a whole right now are, from a legacy standpoint, quite high because that's how they've been. There's no reason they need to be that. They've just been that way. Now's the time to reinvent what the cost of medical devices are, because when you can do that, you can level the playing field on the actual devices and otherwise, and open up the quality of care needed when a clinician can use the tools that they feel they need to use.
So Peter, does your team design these apps, or do you adapt them? What's the connection between human condition and these iPhone medical apps?
Yes, so both from a design standpoint, consultant standpoint, working with other companies that have, say, an existing medical company that has, you know, does physical medical products. They're now understanding that they don't need to worry about necessarily creating a brand new set of circuitry and otherwise. It's an extreme amount of cost. The FDA issue on that side of getting every piece of hardware through that process, the FCC, Federal Communications. So if it's wireless, you have something that's already packaged as a device and now looking to help fast-track elements through FDA and otherwise, because the device itself is really a beautiful. Again, this is iPhone, but I just want to, you can see the other devices behind that, Android, even BlackBerry. It doesn't really matter so much the device, just that the power is there at this point. You're welcome. I've also done a lot of work in the nonprofit space, as I said, and this was a really interesting challenge. We got involved with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation just as Buffett's money was coming in as the endowment. So now you had an organization that now had $60 billion liquid for doing good. They quickly became the largest NGO in the world. Before that, the IKEA Foundation was the largest at $40 million. Most people don't know IKEA even had a foundation, but it was the largest healthcare foundation before that time in pure dollar size. Gates Foundation at this point was really trying to help communicate how do you talk to a global audience about dealing with this type of money. So there's a lot of thought at the time and still till today, if you have $60 billion, well, if we just could use $60 billion, we could cure AIDS, we could cure cancer, we could cure, you know, the top 10 diseases. The reality is we know we can't do that in a day. So it was really a conversation of how do we communicate that with this money, if we can cure TB in 10 years or 15 years, minus a day, we save 8,000 lives. And minus 2 days, we save 16,000 lives. And what is the actual metric? What is the cost of that? So if you can reduce, if you can get to the cure by 1 year, it's 1.42 million people. It's an amazing amount of people you can affect. So it's not about the challenge of, you know, with this amount of money, solving it tomorrow. And then we worked with them on finding really interesting emerging healthcare technologies as well so that they could do this in their different programmatic areas. So people are familiar with the $2 drinking straw filtration system, possibly. Basically, this idea that you can literally take the straw, drink from a polluted river or other water source, and have clean drinking water from that. It tastes clean. It's scrubbed of all bacteria and otherwise. But the idea that it's $2 and it can be disposable or reused a few times. And it's evolved quite a bit. And it's interesting finding those technologies because before talking about what could be possible on that side, the closest filtration system, portable, was $1,800. And that doesn't have a very high output. You're only talking about maybe 1.2 liters per hour of filtration. So if you think about that for communities drinking water, sharing 1.2 liters in an hour among 40, 50, 60, 200 people, it's not practical. Not practical at all. So it was interesting, and this is a part of the interesting technology side of it. You have the Gates Foundation, founded by Mr. Bill Gates, Mr. Technology on that side. And they really had no sense of how to adapt what their modern U.S. and global technology systems were to these emerging problems. They don't deal with that. It wasn't part of the, they were worried about business processes and otherwise from an application standpoint. Now, databases and email programs and servers and otherwise, they do come into use, obviously, but when you're dealing with a small clinic in the middle of nowhere, no one cares about the server, the cloud, Excel. It doesn't exist because there's no power. It doesn't matter. So looking at these different challenges from that side was really interesting and led me onto having this idea of creating a way to help tell these stories because they're fascinating stories, but how do you communicate this to a larger audience so they really understand what's going on around the world so that the problems, often you have to travel to a place to really see problems before you can solve them. So how can you bring the problems to people because it's much less expensive than shipping a lot of people to solve the problem. How can you bring the problems to talent and otherwise to actually start looking at these? So I started this organization called Clinics Rising to do just that. So we basically created a philanthropic organization that we would send people into areas documenting both from a audio and media and visual side, but also a high level of data acquisition to be able to package that and then bring that to groups, everything from the World Health Organization, Gates Foundation, Clinton Initiative, and otherwise to help tell this larger story. So I'm just going to give you a little peek. It's a short film that we created based on a small clinic we were working with in northern Rwanda.
The healthcare delivery system. So approximately in Rwanda, we have 400 doctors and like 120-something specialists for a population of 10 million. It's a very big problem.
The Rwandan conflict had a devastating effect on not only the Rwandan people, but on the infrastructure systems of the country, including the healthcare delivery system, which has hampered the government's ability to provide comprehensive primary healthcare to the majority of the population. While much international aid and attention has been given to Rwanda over the past 15 years in the form of HIV/AIDS and malaria protocols, medicine, and volunteer doctors, little has been done to rebuild the system at the rural community level.
In Rwanda, we have like four levels of health care. We have the community health workers. This is the first contact of health in the community, and they don't have any medical background. And then from the community health worker, there's the health worker. And it's approximately the ratio is like one nurse for 1,500 citizens. And from the health center, we go to the district hospital. And from the district level, there's a fourth level of referral, which is the university teaching hospital.
Health centers in Rwanda are the gateways to the entire healthcare system. Before a patient can be seen at the district or referral hospital, they must first be seen at their local health center.
In Rwanda, in Rwanda, primary healthcare is important because it is a developing country, it is a poor country, and you can't be developed really if you are not healthy, because it really helps. And if we improve the primary care, and then
the reason we ended up, after doing a couple of years of research focusing on the delivery system, was the research showed us that an awful lot of the aid going to Africa was what we described as vertical and narrow. When they get to a country like Rwanda, the delivery system was not sufficiently developed for them to actually deliver the protocol to the people who need it. We decided to work on the horizontal, the delivery system that could use all of these different protocols. I worked on teams all my life, and this team is as good as any Western team that I have worked with in the last 40 years.
So our project director is an A1 nurse, 45 years old, who has a broad range of experience in healthcare. We have a logistics coordinator. You need to know who to go to buy things, where you find things, someone to negotiate price with.
We have an operations coordinator who is responsible for infrastructure changes, planning them, establishing a budget, going out for bids for the work, supervising the work, and again, making sure that provisions are found in order to complete the project. We now have a medical coordinator, Dr. Natalie, so that she is guiding us in terms of developing medical processes and programs and protocols.
What's great about our team is that we're able to hold both like the international American perspective with the Rwandan perspective. And we just all are focused on the same thing, just trying to build this model for primary healthcare delivery. And we use the best ideas from the international world to the best ideas from the Rwandan world. And it really works incredibly well.
In 2008, Chicks was asked by the Rwandan government to team up with the Shingiro Health Center. At the time, Shingiro was ranked 7th out of the 11 health centers in its district. There was no running water, no electricity, and the medical facilities were unsanitary. It was here that Chicks developed the model for primary health care delivery.
Well, the key to how Chicks works is that we try to first understand the system and the situation that we're coming into. So the first step that we take is to try to go to the meeting of them, understand what their problems are. Second thing we have to do is ask them to get their involvement, see what they think are the major problems and see what we address and see what we can do. And then the third thing we always have to make sure is that they know exactly what shit is, what we're trying to do, and how we work.
Key aspect of the CHIPS model is the emphasis on management systems and processes. This includes both installing new organization structures and training the health center management team important management and leadership skills. The medical processes also play an essential role. The lack of formal medical education for healthy staff is a serious impediment to quality medical care. Since Jinx has begun working with Shimura, deliveries have increased by over 24%. Curative consultations have grown by over 65%, and total patient consultations have grown over 86%. The Rwandan government has welcomed safe policies and programs for vaccination, family planning, health and hygiene, nutrition, and mental health. Shinks has held the implementation of these programs to great success. In the nutrition program, Shinks has identified each of the at-risk children in the area. These children, along with their mothers, come from the health center gateway and are taught by the health center staff about the effects of malnutrition, as well as instructed on how to prepare nutritious meals. 96 children have graduated the program, and no children have abandoned the program this year. Vaccination for infants is also a critical aspect of preventative health. With the vaccination program, hundreds of mothers with newborns come to the health center to have their babies weighed, examined by a nurse, and have their vaccines administered. Involving the community is essential for the success of the health center. In Rwanda, a network of volunteers called health animators are responsible for communication between the health centers and the surrounding population. Shifts trains and assists these animators in their effort to connect the health center and its primary healthcare services to the community. Several of the more important government measures, Shigeru has improved by nearly 50%, while the other health centers have lost ground.
We always say we're trying to create a model, an operating model.
So this film was shot over 2.5 years. There was three health centers that the CHIPS program was working with, and I'll explain very quickly. The people you saw on screen are Bill and Roe Wyman. Bill Wyman was a founding partner of Oliver Wyman, one of the world's largest management consulting firms. I started work with them through a mutual colleague, and they became our first case study, if you will, of really looking into the issues and seeing how we could help from that standpoint. This film ultimately ends up as helping them with both fundraising, but ultimately the really beautiful success of this entire project was from these three health centers and the efficacy that they brought to them. They increased, Rwanda has a national health care insurance program. It's $7 per person annually. But the issue was that you really didn't have much of an attrition rate. It was only about 5% of the population. After running these programs and finding through technology, sometimes the simplest solution was it was actually $2 a year for the health insurance. The rest went for the photo. They couldn't afford the photo. That's why they wouldn't get the health insurance. So So what we did is basically with $99 web cameras and existing old school computers and not a lot of technology, did free photos from the clinic that basically cost the clinic nearly nothing, maybe $40 a year in supplies from that side, from a sustainability side. So doing that, we went from 5% in 2006 to 95% healthcare coverage in 2008. So 2 years through a very simple, adding a webcam and a printer. I mean, it's really amazing what technology can do. When you look at it from a different way, make sure you understand the full problem and dig in deeply in finding ways to solve that. So I have more in the presentation, but I think we're up on time.
Okay, so 10 minutes, so maybe what would be, first of all, you know, cool, very cool. Maybe now you could talk about what are your plans for the future and what sort of other relationships you're trying to build. I think that's what our audience would be interested in.
Sure, absolutely. One of the biggest things we're excited about right now, we have a program with we're in a joint venture with one of my other business colleagues, in this program called EDPS, Early Detection Prevention System. And what it does is it gets a very simple logic system of diagnosis into the hands of these non-trained healthcare workers to go deeper into the villages, further out, and be able to go through, they're using very, very basic text cell phone technology, which now exists over much of Rwanda, and not needing laptops or tablets or anything like that, to do a very basic assessment, bring that back to the healthcare facility. Then a clinician looks through all of that data. Usually it results in two or three possible diagnoses. What it really does, though, beyond just purely the diagnosis in that side, it creates an amazing amount of sensors. So now you have all these healthcare workers that are out in the field. You now have sensors. We can detect within 24 hours if an epidemic or pandemic is breaking out and in multiple villages at once, because by the time that data comes home at the end of the day, you have a real-time data stream. Now, one thing I want to mention quickly about this CHIPS program as a whole, these three clinics, because of interesting programs like this, the Rwanda Ministry of Health is now adopting the CHIPS model all across Rwanda. Every single clinic, every healthcare facility within Rwanda will now use this model. They found it has saved them an enormous amount of money, and the effectiveness is, the metrics are so stunning. I mean, you can't even compare it to any other program that's come. Now that's with, and not to take away from anything Gates or Clinton Initiative or otherwise are doing, groups that have spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars in country have never been able to do this. This entire program was funded by $300,000. Now it's going to be the national system. Because when you go to a low cost, you start looking you're looking for efficiencies. You're looking for things that really, you know, can make something embed. If there's a problem, you're going to feel it so much sooner. So, you know, with a lot of money, it creates our thresholds raised to pain, if you will, if a system doesn't necessarily work. It's going to be that many years longer that we find out that it doesn't work or otherwise. So there's a very interesting kind of mix of, you know, adding small technology, keeping costs low, testing, lots of iteration. You know, the idea that I don't know is okay, let's find it out together. And working, obviously, with the local people, and that's why I, you know, turn that even domestically and otherwise into our first world, if you will, of working with patients to find issues. You know, I think it's really important from this side, always working with patients. I found a lot of issues where, you know, the patient is looked at as this almost separate entity, and, you know, embrace the patient. They're a human being. They need compassion. They're more scared than anybody else is. They're frustrated. If you think you're frustrated as a clinician trying to find what's going on, think of how they feel. And I think that's ultimately a lot of what we're trying to do through these technologies. Yeah, we did a full metrics, a pre and post simulation metric, and then multiple months later online as well for the program group. And it was very interesting to watch the shift. We would ask someone from an empathy standpoint, when a patient complains of pain, your class 2 patient complains of chest pain, how would you rate that on a scale from a typical average? And that would usually end up a 2 or 3 on a scale of 1 to 10. Post-simulation and following months after, you know, long after they experienced it, they're usually shifted to an 8 or 9 on that scale. So we were able to watch that stay, because these experiences stayed with people for a very long time. A, they were visceral, they're physical. You can't forget them. I had the head of nursing at the Atlanta VA call me out of the blue back in February, and she said, could we have the heart failure simulator for our school. Could it come down to, could it come down to the VA? And I said, I'd love it to, but it's been decommissioned currently and otherwise. And she was talking about vivid details within the simulation that I forgot, and I'm the guy who designed it. I mean, it was amazing. And she was also coming up with things that weren't in the simulation because her mind put the two things together. And there were things that we knew we couldn't do because, A, we didn't have the budget or the time frame, but we wanted that idea of the symptomology. And she was actually connecting the dots on her own because of what was delivered to her. Sure. Well, I think, you know, Jefferson has a
couple hours.
You know, Jefferson has an amazing program from, you know, having a fully kind of working physical simulation that embodies a lot of different types of simulations. You know, these types of simulations are just one form of it. There's so many different types of simulation. Military uses entirely different. Everything we're looking at really comes from the flight industry, which is the longest practiced form of simulation. Meaning simulation can start on paper. It can go to the highest level of immersion and anywhere in between. And what we're really trying to do at this point is looking to help increase the fidelity of simulation, but understand when enough is enough for fidelity. Because if you add too much fidelity, sometimes you can take away from the program areas or otherwise. So something like your facility here, you know, adding within the hallways a cacophony of noise, pager calls through the PA system, people making noise, a baby crying, you know, adding a cacophony, because that's the distraction point. You know, the more that you can add real-world noise and distraction, that's when you can train someone to forget about it all. And then the moment they're embedded into that situation, they're now comfortable with that side of it, and they can focus at the task on hand.
Well, Peter,
thank you.
Really,
thank you.